We don't have jurisdiction over international waters, but this is one way that Alaska will be able to protect our shores by participating in this important dialogue.
Lawmakers push for an Arctic Policy Commission. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Tanana River Bridge Project gets underway.
And we are anticipating resuming work on the levee next week.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing financial tools and resources for purchasing a home or planning for the future. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
The House last night approved spending more than $9.5 billion for the operations of state government, some $6 billion of it in state revenue. Finance co-chair Bill Thomas said the plan would require oil prices to average about $100 a barrel next year to avoid deficit spending. Thomas told members that the budget spends $1.5 billion on education. Health and social services expenses total more than $2.6 billion. The operating budget next goes to the Senate, then a conference committee to work out the differences the two bodies have. The state legislature is making progress toward establishing an Arctic Policy Commission. At a hearing of the House Finance Committee, Representative Reggie Jewell explained that even though Alaska is the country's only Arctic state, it's often left out of the conversations about federal policy concerning the region. He thinks that having a body responsible for developing an Arctic strategy would give the state more credibility with regulators in Washington.
When we went and addressed the State Department, Department of Interior, it is amazing what people do not know about our state that should be basic, and they get to make budget decisions. And I think it's imperative that the legislature stay involved in this process.
The idea for the Alaska Arctic Policy Commission came out of the Northern Waters Task Force, a state body that had a similar mission, but was only meant to exist for 2 years. If established, the Alaska Arctic Policy Commission would pick up where the task force left off. It would also be expanded to include representatives from industry, academia, conservation groups, and the state's tribes. Unalaska City Manager Chris Laddick served on the Northern Waters Task Force and testified at the hearing. He stated that setting up a commission now is important since the pace of Arctic development is picking up.
I believe that all of us are going to be affected, every Alaskan, sooner or later by what's coming in the future. And obviously drilling in the Arctic, if it happens this summer, is going to be a big impact. Shipping over the pole, conflicts with shipping, with commercial fishing, grounds, et cetera, et cetera.
The commission would have 17 members, and it would be funded at $600,000 over the next 3 years. It would be required to file a report on the state of Arctic policy in 2015. The House today agreed with the Senate's request that the Arctic Council Task Force consider Alaska's interests in establishing standards for shipping and oil pollution preparedness for Arctic waters. Bethel Democrat Bob Heron, in presenting the resolution that had already passed the Senate, said the state is looking for requirements that all vessels in the Aleutians and the Bering Straits have adequate oil spill contingency plans and that they voluntarily comply with the state's oil spill and response rules.
As you know, there have been recent events that have impacted the Aleutian Islands. Cooperation will be the key in successful prevention response efforts. We don't have jurisdiction over international waters, but this is one way that Alaska will be able to protect our shores by participating in this important dialogue.
The Arctic Council Task Force for Arctic Marine Oil Pollution Preparedness and Response will begin its meetings in Girdwood next week. Work is about to resume on the biggest construction project in the interior. What will be the state's longest bridge is being built by the Alaska Railroad across the Tanana River near Salcha. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
It may seem like it's still winter outside, but the spring equinox and startup to construction season on the $188 million Tanana Crossing comes next week. Mark Peterbers, the Alaska Railroad's project director, says the contractor, Kiewit Infrastructure West, has already had workers out and about over the past couple of weeks getting equipment and the worksite ready for operations.
Kiewit, the general contractor, has started to remobilize. They have a few people on site getting equipment ready and brushing the snow off of the construction areas. And we are anticipating resuming work on the levee next week.
Peterbers says the work that will be going on till midsummer will involve construction of a levee along the east bank of the Tanana, the Salcha side, which should help keep the river from flooding so much as it does every year, making life more difficult for a few dozen households in the area. Peterbers says work also will begin soon on a temporary structure called a causeway that will enable equipment to get farther out into the river channel so workers can begin building piers on which the permanent bridge frame will be built.
So that will be they call a causeway, which is basically similar to a levee. You know, it's built with riprap for a certain distance, and then there will be a trestle to keep allow water to go under it, and then more causeway and trestle.
That kind of work will continue throughout the next year in a slow sort of leapfrog progression westward across the river, one pier at a time. When completed in the fall of 2014, the 3,000-foot bridge will provide year-round access for the military to get troops and equipment to the big training ranges on the west side of the Tanana. That was the main reason for this first phase of the overall project called the Northern Rail Extension, which was funded mostly by the federal government. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the debate over the Anchorage Prop 5 issue heats up.
It made me question why he felt like he needed to misrepresent me.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Join business, civic, and government leaders from across Alaska and the nation at the 2012 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, April 19th and 20th at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. Clean energy is a $250 billion a year business worldwide, and Alaska has the potential to be a world leader in this growing field. Information at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
This winter's deep snow is likely to mean fewer moose in a part of the state where moose populations were already in trouble. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
At a meeting of the Federal Subsistence Board's South Central Regional Advisory Council, Andy Loringer, refuge manager for the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, said the ratio of bulls to cows is one measure of a moose population's health. Low bull-cow ratios raise concerns, he says, that not all cows are being bred or that many are breeding later in the season, causing calves to be born smaller going into the winter, reducing their survival rates. He says parts of the refuge once sustained high bull-cow ratios.
You look at the refuge and how it sits, some of the areas, the higher country and the Tustamina benchlands and in the Kenai Mountains, you know, had bull-cow ratios of 60 to 70 historically. And so, you know, our average bull-cow ratio objectives of 25 to 30, 35 are for those areas that traditionally had bull-cow ratios in the 50 to 60 or 70 range even.
He says those high bull-cow ratios are a thing of the past.
Of course, it differs from area to area, but it was below 10 bulls per 100 cows in large areas of the peninsula last year. And our objective levels, the objective levels of the Department of Fish and Game are 15 to 20 bulls per 100 cows. So considerably, it had dropped considerably below those objectives. And on the refuge, the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, our objective is slightly higher than that, bull cow ratios of 25 to 30.
Loringer says part of the problem in recent years is that too many yearling bulls were being taken. Accordingly, the refuge reduced the harvest last year to try and quickly reverse a downward trend and achieve a better bull-cow ratio. In 2010, 395 moose were taken. In 2011, that harvest was cut by 92% to 32 moose. Of those, 4 were taken by subsistence hunters. South Central Regional Advisory Council member Greg Enchalewski of Nanilchik suggested that to sustain a subsistence hunt, the refuge consider allowing hunters to take cow moose.
All we've been hearing about for the last couple of years about the Kenai Peninsula is that the habitat now is nothing what it was, you know, years ago when there were large-scale fires that ended up producing these incredibly big moose herds. And I think one interesting way to deal with that is by offering some limited antlerless hunts to subsistence users on the Kenai Peninsula.
Wildfires leave areas for new growth, providing excellent browse for moose. To open new antlerless hunts on federal lands on the Kenai Peninsula would require a proposal to the Federal Subsistence Board. Meanwhile, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is proposing changes that would give Loringer more flexibility to leave hunting open in some areas while closing others where harvest limits have been reached. Loringer says the end of winter through May is a critical time of year for moose. He says the number that survived this winter won't be known until after that. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
Increased wildfire frequency threatens the survival of northern black spruce forests. That's the finding of a recently published research from the Yukon Territory. Sherbrooke University biologist Carissa Brown's doctoral project looked at black spruce regeneration in burn areas. The trees depend on wildfire to stimulate seed release, a cycle based on 80 to 100-year wildfire intervals. Brown says as fire frequency increases closer to 15-year intervals, there's not enough time for new trees to mature and produce seed cones.
Seed stores have been reduced or basically eliminated, and seed availability is absent. And these two factors together are what will likely cause a long-term disruption in these stands.
The increase in wildfire interval is associated with climate warming that's been presumed to spread trees farther north. But Brown says her research on test plots of trees in the northern Yukon suggests that might not be the case. Brown says the demise of black spruce also has the potential to accelerate warming because the boreal forest and underlying permafrost soil it covers hold vast stores of carbon. The debate around Proposition 5 in Anchorage is starting to heat up. The proposition on the April municipal ballot would provide legal protections against discrimination for gay, lesbian, and transgender people. Last month, the anti-Prop 5 group Protect Your Rights launched a website called protectanchorage.org. On the website, the organizer of that group and the head of the Alaska Family Council, Jim Minery, quoted openly gay Anchorage Daily News columnist Julia O'Malley to make the point that the kind of discrimination that Prop 5 would prevent does not exist in Anchorage.
Her column basically said it doesn't matter. She's been openly gay since she was 17 in Anchorage, and it didn't matter if she approached her hairdresser or the cable guy or the postman. I can't remember all the different examples that she used, but she said, I have never felt intolerated. I have never felt anything but respect. And then we basically said, amen, Julia. She was, of course, wanting to have this ordinance passed. But another quote that she thought she had in that article, which I thought was very interesting, was that laws, in her experience, will never change people's hearts. It's personal relationships. And another thing that we said amen to, because you cannot legislate anything that will require or affect people's hearts. And that's what this is truly about.
Minnery posted excerpts from the column on his website, but took them down after Julia O'Malley complained he was taking her words out of context. O'Malley says she supports Prop 5 because it offers peace of mind to gay, lesbian, and transgender people in Anchorage, but she also stresses that she is not working for the campaign or associated with its organization. She describes her reaction when she saw her words used on the anti-Prop 5 site.
You know, honestly, it made me question why he felt like he needed to misrepresent me. If he didn't have, you know, valid support for that assertion, I guess that would be the reason that he would need to misrepresent my words as support for what he's saying. The column that he uses was written before some of the most destructive parts of the conversation about, you know, the 2009 assembly vote had occurred. When I wrote it, I hadn't sat in a room full of people who wanted to explain why I personally and also gay people are dangerous to children and dangerous to communities and sick and perverted and wrong and shouldn't, you shouldn't rent. People who wanted to explain why they wanted to discriminate, why they did not want to rent to gay people or do business with them. I hadn't yet heard all of that, for one thing. Also, the part of the column that he's, you know, using is where I'm really speaking to my own community about how I think that it's important to come out, because when you do, by and large, the response that you get is positive. And I think that the single most important thing a gay person can do politically is to come out, because that lets other people see that you are normal. You're not biting the heads off chickens. You're just another person going home at night making dinner, you know, with the same sorts of concerns. And that's why – and so Minnery using that makes me, I guess, also kind of angry, because it's really unfair when I certainly don't support what he's saying to use my words against the community that I'm part of.
Hindsight's always an interesting thing, but do you wish that you hadn't written what you did, or do you see it differently now?
Yes and no. I guess, you know, knowing what I know now, it makes me feel as though I'm not allowed to be honest about my own experience, you know, because I'm part of a larger movement, you know, and part of me thinks, well, maybe, you know, that was too subtle. The rest of the column talks about my mother and my grandmother, both political figures in town who've worked to have this measure passed over a 30-year period. And at one point in the column, I talk about how my grandmother had a cross burned in her front yard for her support for this in Nunaka Valley. And so I guess I think it's really important for there to be diversity of voices in my community. And just because I am not telling a victim's story does not mean I don't think that there are people in my community that are victims of discrimination. What my story shows is the way in which the movement has progressed, you know, and the way in which the people's efforts before me have allowed me to have more opportunity. You know, so does that work against my community? I don't think so, you know, in the end.
Julia O'Malley is a columnist for the Anchorage Daily News.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
This week on AK, Love of the Race. Every year, Alaska hosts two nearly 1,000-mile sled dog races within weeks of each other, the Iditarod and the Yukon Quest. Though similar in length, racing each one is a very different experience. APRN field reporter Ann Hillman caught up with two mushers who ran both races this year soon after they crossed the Iditarod finish line in Nome.
If you're outside of the mushing world and you think about Alaska's two major long-distance races, you probably think, what's the difference? It's teams of big, fuzzy dogs pulling a sled through cold weather over rough terrain in the middle of nowhere. Actually, truthfully, if you're not even from Alaska, you probably didn't even know that there was a race other than the Iditarod. But a select group of mushers runs both of the intense races back-to-back each year. This year was six-time Quest musher Brent Sass's first Iditarod. He placed 13th and took Rookie of the Year. He says the two races attract different types of mushers.
One of the biggest differences that you see in between Quest and Iditarod is that when you're out in the Quest, everyone out there, it's a little different. Here you get a more of a smorgasbord of people. There's a lot more variety of people that are doing this. There's a bucket list to check it off, or they just do it every year because that's what they do, you know. And you don't do the Quest every year because that's what you do. You do the Quest every year because you really enjoy torturing yourself at times, you know?
Sass says the Quest provides more of a wilderness experience, whereas the Iditarod involves many, many more people.
I think overall the Iditarod has more people, more stops, and I think that creates more challenges on some fronts, especially for someone like me who's used to being able to get out on the trail on the Quest and kind of disappear and be away from the people.
He says the atmosphere of the Quest appeals to him more.
In the Quest, you can leave and you get 2 days where you're in your dog, it's you and your dogs, and that's all you're thinking about, that's all you have to worry about. Here, you know, you go 18 miles and there's another checkpoint, or you go 30 miles and there's another checkpoint. So you get a little thrown off from your focus. There's more decisions to be made, I think. Like, especially for being a rookie, I would roll and do a checkpoint, and as I'm rolling in, I'm going, am I staying, am I going?
One thing that isn't different for Sass in either race is his attitude and how it affects his dogs.
It is. Attitude is everything in life in general, and I think in dog mushing even more so, just because you're feeding that energy right into all your dogs, and if you have a positive, upbeat attitude, all your dogs are going to have that too. So
his positive relationship with them shows as he nuzzles one of his younger dogs, Carbon.
He's like my little buddy. You know, I have awesome relationships with all my dogs. I spend a lot of time with them. I spend all my time with them. You know, they come in the house a lot, and we're tight. We're all very, very tight.
Just as Sass feeds off the energy of his pups, when this year's Yukon Quest champion, Hugh Neff, rolled into Nome at 11:41 on Wednesday night in 17th place, he seemed to feed off the energy of the crowd.
Welcome to Nome!
Good to be home!
Nome, sweet Nome, you man!
My whole race was about one thing, and that was getting to Nome, because I love Nome.
When talking about the highlights of the race for him, he focused on interactions with the communities along the trail.
For me, when I get to Nikolai, and the people of Nikolai are out there getting water ready for us and making food and just going all out, that's when you realize that, you know, what Joe Reddington wanted to happen is actually happening.
When Neff had trouble along the trail with dehydrated dogs who cramped up and had to be carried in his sled, he eventually accepted that he wouldn't be able to repeat Lance Mackey's feat of winning both the Yukon Quest and the Iditarod in the same year. But he said it gave him the chance to relax and socialize.
Basically, the last couple of days, it's just been fun hanging out with some of the, guys that have been around the block, the Rick Swenson and Paul Gebhardt, and obviously Michelle and I have been together the last couple of days, so.
Michelle Phillips arrived in Nome about 23 minutes before Neff. They spent a couple of hours in safety just hanging out. They weren't being challenged by mushers behind them and couldn't catch up to the mushers in front anyhow. For Neff, the Iditarod was a social experience as well as a mushing one. And for all of the mushers on both of the races, it was a chance to be out on the trail, doing what they love most, with a team of dogs who love running it with them. In Nome, I'm Ann Hillman for APRN.
And now it's time for our weekly trip around the state for 300 villages. This week, we're visiting Unalakleet, where the excitement of the Iditarod has just wrapped up.
My name is Jalene Johnson, and I'm from Unalakleet.
Well, my sister just opened a coffee shop, Cool Beans, and so I'm running it during the day for her. People say, where are you from? It's like Uniqlo. When you grow up in Uniqlo, you know, and then you listen to other people and it's like Uniqlo, you know, and they add the extra lot. Yeah, the Iditarod was different. It was more community-based. You know, the whole community got into it, and the mushers stayed at people's houses. Well, they used to actually have this kind of like sign-up sheet for the new mushers, you know, like if you want a musher to stay at your house, you know, just put your name down. But all the older mushers, you know, they always stayed at the same person's house. It is hard to find seal skins. They have some kind of a disease. They have sores and hair loss, you know. They look like they're getting bald. I think people are kind of like scared to even touch them, you know. Because they, from what I read, they're not really sure what's causing it or if it'll make you sick. And the price has gone up dramatically. I mean, you know, you could, if you had a stash of seal skin somewhere, you know, you could make a lot of money now. It's really amazing. They, you know, they shoot the ugruk, drag it onto the ice. You know, if it's not, you're lucky if you catch it and it's laying on the ice, you know. And it's just, it's a lot of fun. It's springtime, it's warm. The sun doesn't go down till 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, if it even does. So, and it's always bright, and it's fun.
That was Jillene Johnson, who runs Cool Beans Coffee Shop in Uniqlo. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK This Week. We had help from Ann Hillman on the Iditarod Trail and Annie Feit and Dave Waldron in Anchorage. Tune in next week for more great stories of life in Alaska. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez and Juno, Tim Ellis and Delta, Dan Bross and Fairbanks, Jacqueline Estes, Ellen Lockyer, and Dacia Eaton in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juno. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees. Join business, civic, and government leaders from across Alaska and the nation at the 2012 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, April 19th and 20th at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. Clean energy is a $250 billion a year business worldwide, and Alaska has the potential to be a world leader in this growing field. Information at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers loans tailored for first-time home buyers, plus home choice education seminars that can help determine if a mortgage would be less than rent. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.